Today's episode of The Scathing Atheist is brought to you by Deuteromino's Pizza. Try some of our angelic wings, our cheese's crust, or our delicious salad with all the crucifixins. Every pie is sliced by Christ just for you. Deuteromino's, delivering you from evil in 30 generations or less. And now, The Scathing Atheist.
That's why the Declaration and the Constitution have lasted over 230 years. Because they were divine revelation from God.
I'm Chuck Vonderay, president of Atheist Alliance of America. And we did, in fact, evolve from filthy monkey men.
Thursday, it's July 18th, and during Ramadan, Muslims are like Mogwais, but in reverse. I'm your host, Noah Illusions, and from sweltering New York, New York, this is The Scathing Atheist. In this week's episode, we'll learn that Deuteronomy is really repetitive, we'll learn that Deuteronomy is really repetitive, and we'll have to turn off the window unit while we record. But first, the diatribe. Last Saturday, Heath and I were invited to MC a roast for a mutual friend that was moving out of town. We were delighted to do it, but the guy we were roasting is exactly the kind of guy you hate to roast. He has no flaws. He's in good shape, he's good-looking, he's confident, he's talented, he's intelligent, he seems to have a new woman on his arm every weekend, so he's not exactly the cornucopia of personal defects that you hope for in a roast victim. So most of us are forced to make jokes about the number of different women he'd slept with in the time we knew him. Now, it's a roast, and in a roast, the guest of honor isn't the only guy that gets ripped on. Everybody rips on everybody, and that's the fun of it. We make fat jokes about the fat guy. We make bald jokes about the bald guy. We make timid jokes about the black guy, and I'm the atheist guy, so they make atheist jokes about me. Now, it's a roast. I'm a good sport about this stuff, so I smile and I laugh along. Hell, I started making God jokes early on, so I wasn't about to take anything said about me or my beliefs personally. But there was one brief exchange in the roast that I thought was worth reflecting on. Now, before we get to the exchange, I need to play a clip to set it up. This is a skit that I wrote that revolved around a mock scrapbook of memorabilia that I was leafing through.
It's a bunch of lovely memories that we have together. And there's a couple of things in here that I wanted to share with you. This is your Rewards Plus card from the abortion clinic. You can hold on to that. And, oh, dude, you almost filled it out. This is New York City fuck list. And he almost checked everything off of here. Holy shit. I think the only ones he didn't check off were Mermaid, Zoroastrian, and someone with who I am in a loving and honest relationship. So you can keep that. There's
Trust me, that clip eventually matters to this story. Anyway, a little later, the dude that we all knew was going to bomb is up. It's this awkward 4 minutes of him trying to figure out why he'd volunteered for this in the first place. And as he wrapped up, he closed by turning to me and making corrections regarding two things I had said in the evening.
Yo, we had some times. And yo, by the way, we fucked mermaids. We did fuck mermaids. I'm a preach on that. Like, check that shit off the fucking list. Believe in God, man. Try it. Yo, listen, I love you, man. Yo, listen, for real, I love you. I love these people. And that's it. I don't do this shit.
He tried real hard, guys. All I'm saying is I'm way more likely to buy the mermaid thing than the God thing. So,
now, like I said, this is a roast. I definitely didn't take his little, hey, man, believe in God thing personally. Earlier in the night, one guy did a mock dialogue where I tried to explain the intellectual justification for my atheism to St. Peter, which was actually fucking hilarious. And another guy thanked me for providing an example of atheism that would lead so many people to Christ. It's a roast. That's the point. And if the only time a Christian had ever said to me, hey, man, you should try believing in God, was during a roast, I wouldn't have bothered to reflect on it at all. But I think we've all heard this or the equivalent of it plenty of times before. You say, I'm an atheist, and somebody just stares at you wide-eyed and jaw-agape and offers an incredulous, really? It's hard to imagine this kind of reaction to other groups. It's hard to imagine a person saying, have you tried not being a Jew or Muslim, huh? How the fuck did that happen? Or did you become a Christian because Buddha disappointed you? But in at least most of this country, when you meet an atheist, it's socially acceptable to throw holy water at him and yell, the power of Christ compels you. Now, in the interest of fairness, there are also plenty of places in this country where you get the same blank-faced stare if you said you were a Christian. Places like institutions of higher learning, science labs, and the East Village. And there are parts of this country, like the one where I grew up, where you could earn such a stare for any answer to the faith question other than Baptist, so we're not the only ones who face this kind of shit. That being said, I think it's fair to say that through most of America, atheist is the only answer to the religious questions that people feel no social qualms at all about trying to talk you out of.
They're talking about your Jesus.
We interrupt this broadcast and bring you a special news bulletin.
Joining me for headlines tonight is a man who needs an introduction, Heath Enright. Heath, you've been introduced. Say something to all the listeners.
I'd like to start by apologizing for a Sarah Palin joke last week that mentioned her son Trigg, who happens to have Down syndrome.
Right.
He's actually a lot brighter than you might think. He's only 5 years old, and he's already reading as many newspapers as his mother.
All of them?
All of them that she can name.
In our lead story tonight, it turns out that despite rumors to the contrary, atheists are normal humans, and apparently a lot of people were really waiting for some hard data before they were willing to make this call.
Well, we're not quite normal. Apparently we do have a normal personality distribution, whatever the fuck that means, but our atheist group has statistically better IQ test-taking ability, or IQ, for example, saying we're fucking smarter than you. We're also, by definition, better at ontology, and that's really the crux of the whole argument, isn't it? I mean, that's the whole podcast is about, the whole question's about, so.
Yes, but the study was not without its flaws. It sloppily categorized non-believers into six groups, and the division prejudiced the fuck out of their conclusions. Some of the categories made sense. They separated out seeker-agnostic and non-theist, which they define as a person who is completely apathetic to religion, but then shit gets pretty wonky.
Yeah, like Gene Wilder as Willy Wonky. The whole study seems like a confused attempt at examining a superior race of aliens or something. Were they hoping to use atheist stem cells to help cure faith cancer? Like, real faith healing? I don't even understand what was happening.
I'm not sure where they were going, but I don't think they got there. Now, here are three separate categories of non-believers according to University of Tennessee researchers. The kind of atheist that reads books and learns stuff, the kind of atheist who is an activist, and the kind of atheist who thinks religion is harmful to society. They actually treat those three characteristics as though they were mutually exclusive.
Doesn't it seem a lot like this study was conceived by the characters from Lord of the Flies or something? One kid says, hey, I think I should explain what a Venn diagram is to you guys. Put that nerd's head on a stick. Kill him.
Right, and because they ignored and killed Piggy, they were able to make some insanely stupid statements like, activist atheists are the least narcissistic and anti-theists are the most angry and dogmatic, without bothering to point out that since these two qualities almost always coexist in a single human, they're using shit like dogmatism and narcissism to define the fucking categories in the first place. And in a transparent attempt to force Heath and I to make testicle jokes tonight, Ball State made waves this week by hiring one Guillermo Gonzalez as a new professor of astronomy, despite his 2004 authorship of a book that pretends that intelligent design is valid science.
Oh, man, you can't do stupid shit when you're called Ball State.
Yes, they can.
Well, yeah, they can indeed. When this guy gets fired for lying on his resume about being a scientist, the headline will certainly read something like, Ball Sack's nutty professor. I mean, it's just waiting to happen. It's just waiting to happen.
The king of the ball joke, Heath Enright. Apparently, the privileged planet was bad enough to prompt 120 faculty members at Iowa State to sign a petition renouncing it when it was rumored that this guy was going to go work there. Gonzalez claims that this was a political move and that a single blogger who isn't even an astronomer was responsible for it. So, yeah. Not only does this guy believe that magic God made shingles on purpose, but he also believes that one blogger can be completely responsible for a petition of 120 people.
And why would the blogger, or anybody else, need to be an astronomer to know that intelligent design is complete nonsense? Is he suggesting right. We should go check with the astronomy community and they'll back him up on the intelligent design thing?
What's worse is that this news comes on the heels of other non-testicular reasons to make fun of Ball State. There's also this ongoing investigation into Ball State Assistant Professor of Physics Eric Hedden, who is accused of essentially teaching a creationism class in the science department.
Well, shouldn't teaching wrong things in any class anywhere be considered a bad thing, science department or no? Also, I think we gotta squeeze more testicle headline jokes in here while we can.
It'd be a slap in the face not to. I mean, there's plenty of low-hanging fruit.
Well, all right. Facing hairy situation, ball trim staff.
More of a sticky situation, I'd say.
New wrinkle everywhere you look.
It is weird that ball now has two dicks.
All right. Feeling his taint, ball gives head and shaft.
What can I say? You're the king. And in this week's child fucking report, the UN's Committee on the Rights of the Child is posed a list of tough questions to the Vatican in preparation for the stern talking to they'll be giving them next January over the systematic child rape, child torture, and consequent global cover-up that has come to define the papacy in recent years.
Define is a strong word. But Rape Scandal Blues is certainly track one, side one of the Vatican's greatest hits over the last 50 years. I personally prefer the older stuff, but they seem to prefer the younger stuff, and that's illegal. So,
now, as insubstantial as a voluntary meeting with a group that has no enforcement powers may seem, this will actually represent the first time that any international panel has had the chance to publicly question the Holy See about this scandal.
Did you guys rape those kids? No.
A bit.
We did do the nose. Many of them had headaches. Begging for it.
That's a callback joke. The Vatican, for its part, is quick to assure the UN that they're doing everything necessary to keep pedophiles away from kids. They've weeded out all the bad seeds. They've definitely stopped running slave laundries in Ireland, and they can totally prove it. But they can also totally pull out of the Treaty of the Rights of the Child, so they're going to definitely do one of those two things. Prove it or pull out of the treaty.
It's too bad they didn't pull out of those kids' assholes when they asked nicely the first time. I think that's where they could have done well to pull out right time. I think I understand part of the confusion, though. I think I do. In the Bible, no means begat, like fuck. But in the real world, no means no. So these weren't rapes as much as homophone issues. You're just a little case of consent getting lost in translation. Huh?
And in how the fuck are we even discussing this news, the Senate may soon consider a revision to FEMA policy that would allow untaxed houses of worship to collect federal disaster relief money.
FEMA doesn't have time for this. They're just barely starting with the fishing the black people out of New Orleans Harbor. Just barely. No?
All right. So under current law, federal disaster relief can only be used to rebuild and repair homes, businesses, and infrastructure. And since churches aren't necessary, should be insured, and can go fuck themselves, they're left to fend for themselves with hopes that the combination of not being taxed and selling a product that doesn't actually exist for money that does will be enough to keep them through the hard times.
Yeah, what's the overhead on selling indulgences? Are they not,
right.
Not able to make enough money or not getting a good enough markup on those lies that generate for free? Managed to get people to pay today for an impossible hamburger they won't get until after they die on Tuesday. How fucking dumb do you have to be?
But thanks to the bipartisan pandering of Republican Senator Roy Blunt of Missouri and Democratic bitch that I actually voted for, Kirsten Gillibrand, all of that could change. Both our tax dollars and our potential future disaster relief dollars might be diverted to characters from Jusop's fables. But don't worry, the bill does stipulate that the federal money can only be used to cover the cost of the building itself, the doors, the windows, the building envelope, physical plant support spaces, electrical, plumbing, heating, ventilation, air conditioning, sprinkler system, and related site improvements. So apparently they're not allowed to use federal money to buy Bibles or pay off sex abuse victims, but everything else would be okay.
Didn't think this would need mentioning or repeating, but money is fungible.
That's the point.
The $10,000 FEMA check stolen from secular taxpayers is very similar in value to 10,000 different dollars. By the same token, giving the church 40,000 taxpayer quarters or 100,000 taxpayer dimes would also clearly violate the First Amendment, wouldn't it?
And finally tonight, we bring you the story of this month's greatest slight against God, montage of crazy YouTube preachers. Would you care to guess what he's pissed about this month?
The wicked evildoers of this country.
Nobody should be wearing makeup.
Whoring society.
A holy ab and hola.
The lesbians. The homos and faggots.
Hola and a hola. Hola bop.
The filth and trash that's on television.
Hola bop. Hola.
Stop it.
Jesus was not a bartender.
Is anybody listening to what I'm saying?
A whore is what she was.
No, I'm sorry, while I'm sure those things pissed him off, he also got snubbed from a Sam Adams commercial.
This might be the best God-snubbing decision since Roe v. Wade.
Now, the ad in question uses a brief appended quote from the Declaration of Independence, with the spokesman saying that the people were, quote, endowed with certain inalienable rights, while conspicuously leaving out the part about those certain inalienable rights coming from a magical man fairy.
You said coming from a magical man fairy. Almost missed that. Sounds like a Joseph on Joseph version of the Immaculate Conception.
Those type of conceptions do tend to be immaculate, I guess.
Imagine how much better the world would be if abortion had only been legal when God went all Roethlisberger on Mary back when.
Yeah, I guess even the conservatives tend to make exceptions in the case to incest and rape, and I guess that was both.
Wow. I mean, it seems like that might have been God's first time, too. I mean, did God really lose his virginity during a magical rape when he was over 1,000 years old? No right. Bullshit story about fucking Eve at summer camp when he's 15 or whatever.
It's from a different people before this universe. You don't know them. And proving once more that there's no rung of pettiness under which religious people can't limbo, the Sam Adams Facebook page was bombarded by Christian jizz rinsers demanding that the company love and fear the Lord our God and threatening to boycott the brand if they didn't issue an apology to Jesus.
Well, the beer is named after Sam Adams. So why didn't they just use the Founding Fathers' actual documented opinion on religion? Tell me this wouldn't move some brew. Sam Adams beer, because Catholicism leads directly to the worst anarchy and confusion, civil discord, war, and bloodshed. Please drink responsibly. Sam Adams.
All right, well, now you've made me thirsty, so we're going to have to close out headlines. But when we come back, for some fucking reason, we're going to talk about Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy's on to me. I gotta say, honestly, I'm not paying the Bible the attention I want to be. It's long and it's dull and it's so full of bull that the stress of the process is hurting my skull. I'm plodding through and I'm human. I've got shit to do, man. I can't study this thing like a Hasidic Jew can, so I skim and I skip and I flip through and scan and I glance at the footnotes here and there where I can, but I'll admit I hit bits I don't get and I'm split. Should I study it further or not give a shit? After all, we're not scholars, and I got no white collar. I'd trade biblical knowledge for Liberian dollars. Besides, most verses are worthless, like the begats and the curses that God intersperses with no discernible purpose. What's worse is the verses they don't read in the churches. I'm not sure why they skip them, though. It'd be a hell of a service, but I digress. And I guess what I mean to express is that no one who reads this thing knows what it says. How could you? Why would you? It'd do you no good. You'd be memorizing words no one understood. True, I guess there's a few that have nothing to do that obsess over passages and pretend that they're true. But what about the incredulous rest of us who stopped listening at Exodus? We're bored and it's nebulous, and among the effects of this are low comprehension and even lower retention. So in hopes of prevention, and to hold your attention, Moses proposes verboseness. He knows us. He rightly supposes we'll be losing our focus. So Deuteronomy's a colloquy that repeats all the policies God laid down earlier about sex and idolatry. A dishonest anthology that restates the chronology and explains the pathology of Jewish theology. So the gist, if you missed it, is that when God gets pissed, it's likely to consist of him swinging his fist. He insists he exists, and if his laws are dismissed, you'll be reaping his vengeance. And he offers a list. And it goes like this. He'll curse your cities and your countries and your baskets and your bowl. He'll curse your womb and curse your vineyard and your cattle and your soul. He'll cause your enemies to rise before you, sword and bloody hand. He'll curse you coming, curse you going, drive you screaming from your land. The Lord will send to you disaster and frustrate your every whim. He'll cover you in leprosy from limb to fucking limb. He'll inflict you with consumption, inflammation, heat, and drought. He'll turn the ground below to iron so no sustenance can sprout. Your corpse will be a meal for every creature on the earth, and your wife will eat your children and her bloody afterbirth. The Lord will give you boils, ulcers, scurvy, and the itch. You'll be abused and robbed and helpless, and your home will be a ditch. Begrudging food to your own brother and to the wife that you embrace, you'll be a pariah to your people and he'll remove you from his grace. You'll starve and want for water and screw up everything you touch because the Lord is wonderful and he loves you very much.
The Holy Babel.
Deuteronomy, the rewrite notes of the Pentateuch. It's repetitive, immoral, disgusting, and verbose, but beyond that, it manages to simultaneously shock and bore you in a way that other books could only dream of. So joining me now to discuss this chore of a book is my lovely wife, Lucinda. Lucinda, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Noah.
And, of course, triangling out this trifecta is Heath Enright, who you'll remember from 2.5 minutes ago. Heath, welcome back. It's been a lonely couple of minutes.
Thank you very much.
So, where would you guys say Deuteronomy ranks so far in terms of boring?
Well, you get Moses telling us what God told him that he already told us that we already read. So, it's pretty fucking boring.
It's like reading about somebody being bored by the book they're fucking reading.
Right.
It's brutal.
Right. Yeah, the word Deuteronomy literally means second law. It consists of three speeches that Moses gives before he dies, and almost no new information comes out. I mean, there's an odd testicle-grabbing rule here and a revision to meat-slaughtering custom there, but basically he's just repeating shit. It's like getting to the first big battle scene in Braveheart and then listening to Mel Gibson deliver the "They'll Never Take Our Freedom" speech for an hour and a half.
Except it comes off less like William Wallace and a lot more like fucking Woody Allen complaining.
So let's just dive in.
All right, we spend the first three chapters listening to Moses brag about his greatest hits, basically. It recaps the bloodiest highlights of Exodus through Numbers. Then we spend chapter four rehashing all of the crap that just happened in the first three. Basically, we rehash the rehash.
And since we're clearly dealing with Moses' farewell concert here, you knew he was going to do the Ten Commandments, so he gives us the long version with the full-blown sax solo and everything.
Play Exodus 20! No, play Exodus 34! Of course the asshole musician has to do all the new and different, so nobody really likes it. It's called Deuteronomy 5 now, man. No more the tired Exodus crap. Wouldn't want to play it like it sounds on the fucking album that brought everyone to the fucking concert in the first place.
Right.
Unbelievable.
And then to chapter 7, God spells out the importance of a good, thorough genocide.
If you're a Jew, you gotta be worried about running into some sort of genocidal backlash one day. I'm just saying. Their strategy of concentrating themselves all in a safe place like Israel seems to be working, but it's dangerous, too. Anyway, by chapter 9, Moses has completed his transformation to Chris Farley. You remember the time when I went up on that mountain and talked to God for a month? Just conduit straight to me? That was awesome. Such an idiot.
By chapter 12, Moses' Alzheimer's has turned into full-blown dementia. I mean, now he's telling the Jews that they can eat meat in the same way they would eat gazelle or deer, which are, of course, vegetables.
Right. Reminded that you can only be Jewish with the help of union rabbis at the union temple. So nothing else counts. Straight to the Levites only.
Then we learn that if you should ever have tangible evidence that God is bullshit, it's just God testing you.
And kill the person with the evidence.
Oh, obviously. Of course. We rehash the rules about diet, then slavery, then holidays, then judges. I swear this fucking book reads like a filibuster.
Like James Joyce delivering a filibuster.
No, this book reads like a Dan Dennett analysis of a James Joyce filibuster. And wow. Then we get a chapter that says, give your shit to the priests when they tell you to, kill the sorcerers, and oh yeah, if anything in this book ever proves to be untrue, we know it isn't the word of God. It actually says that in the book.
Yeah.
And then in 20, Moses spells out the rules of engagement. Before making war with a city, at least offer to enslave all the citizens first and see what they say.
Not like that.
So you start off, you offer them the Billy Martin. Listen, we're willing to overlook the whole thing where you stole our land while we spent 40 years over there in the woods. Just submit to slavery. We takes the women you have on you and he calls it even.
And we're great slave owners, man. Tell you what, if I poke out your eye, I'll let you go. Promise.
Also be sure to kill all the men, steal the women, children, livestock, and riches, of course. Gotta have some Jew gold.
Unless the women and children are Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, or Jebusites, in that case, you have to kill them all.
And whatever you do, do not cut down the fruit trees like a fucking barbarian.
God hates that.
Ruin it.
Then you get chapter 21, CSI Promised Land. If you find a dead body in the street, you just bring out a cow, break his neck, wash your hands over it, problem solved. Also, marrying captive women is okay as long as they're bald and naked.
That's reasonable.
All right.
Slave harem etiquette is important. We're not savages here. Also, if you're into government-sponsored murder, don't hang the victim on a pole for more than a day. That would be ridiculous.
Gross.
In the sequel, we'll get into using two poles to form a T-shape that's useful for public murders of Jewish writers. This is a whole different thing. It's a whole other thing that separate chapters and separate testament. Yep.
Then we get to the chapter where Glenn Beck gets his morality from. Here we finally learn that God hates trannies, though we were suspecting that the whole time, I think. We learned the etiquette of when you can and can't stone someone to death for having a vagina.
Oh, Yeah. I must have missed something. When can't you do that?
The Sabbath?
Once a week, whatever. Also, don't forget to bleed profusely when your husband fucks you. Make sure he sees it happen.
Yeah, I can have that happen. And we learned that if a woman is raped in town, she gets killed along with a rapist. But if she's raped in the country, guys, check it out. She gets to just be a rape victim.
I mean, come on. Being female, in a town, out of earshot, she's basically fucking asking for it, right? Come on, guys.
Now, chapter 24 starts with the words, "No one whose testicles are crushed or whose penis is cut off shall be admitted to the assembly of the Lord."
Okay.
We get some more on nocturnal emissions, and then God actually gives proper instructions for taking a shit.
Yeah, and no shit, cum, or atheists allowed in a foxhole. Very important.
Exactly.
And if your brother dies, you have to fuck his wife, and if you refuse, she gets one of your sandals, and she spits in your face. So, I mean, it sounds like it would go without saying, but they tell you anyway. Just in case.
And if a woman grabs a guy's nutsack when he's fighting her husband, you should cut her hand off. Because that's a no-no.
Clearly.
Again.
Yeah.
And kill every Amalekite on the fucking planet.
Yeah, of course.
I swear, this book is like a sign that says, read this sign. Half the book is spent saying, obey this book or I'll fuck your skull. And I think it's worth mentioning, too, that you get like 3 or 4 chapters in a row of curses. But there's no mention of an afterlife, no mention of post-mortem retribution, no concept of heaven or hell by the people who are writing this book.
At all.
Moving to chapter 31. This one, it gets confusing. Follow me on this one. It starts talking about shit that happened once the book that you're reading was done being written. So the Deuteronomy explains the aftermath of the writing of Deuteronomy and the death of its author, but that's later. So what the fuck's happening?
Right, so we've just been repeating shit the whole time, and even back then they had to know at this point they weren't going to get away with having Moses say the exact same fucking thing that he'd been repeating a dozen times so far.
Yeah, so in chapter 32 he starts singing them. He actually sings about how skull-raped you'll be if you piss God off.
Skull-raped in a bad way, too.
Yeah.
And apparently the Israelites were holding up their lighters or something because he breaks into another song in chapter 33. Well, 12 more songs in chapter 33, one for each fucking tribe.
It's pretty obvious at this point, though, that God must have said to Moses, you know, okay, say your last words and then we kill you, dude. And Moses is just milking it at this point. And now I will sing what I have just said 30 times already and read. Awful.
And then Moses dies on the mountain. And according to the book, it's a pretty spectacular death. But you know how it is when people tell you about their own deaths. They always exaggerate.
Oh, it was frustrating to learn that we could have just skipped from Genesis all the way to Deuteronomy and not missed anything but Moses' origin story and some damn tabernacle details, really. I mean,
right. But in all honesty, though, I'm kind of in a weird way looking forward to Joshua now. It's like I'm done jerking off, but I'm still watching for the money shot. You know, like, I don't care about anything that's going on in the story, but I've made it so far that I just want to see these bitchy Jews inherit the Holy Land already.
Or at the very least, see some jizz on somebody's face so I can get up, wipe my hands on the cat, and get to sleep. It's getting exhausting.
That seems like the exact right note to close on. So, Heath, Lucinda, thanks again for joining me.
Good to be here.
Before we shut down the oven tonight, I wanted to take a minute to thank this week's most unabashedly, flagrantly, shamelessly awesome humans, Rob, Richard, Andrew, and Anne, who affirmed their high-minded beneficence this week by giving us money. In addition to providing all the stuff that makes this show possible, giving us money has also been clinically tested to improve lung function or something. Because seriously, advertisers are now saying things have been clinically tested for stuff and hoping you hear clinically proven. Listen for it. Remember, if you'd like to be slathered and praised by someone who knows nothing about you except your discriminating taste in podcast financing, you'll find the donate button on the right side of our homepage at scathingatheist.com. I also need to throw a big thanks and a big shout out to President of Atheist Alliance of America, Chuck Vondre, for providing this week's Farnsworth quote. It's a great organization, they do great work, and they also have a great convention coming up next month in Boston. The Atheist Alliance of America's 2013 National Convention is stacked. Host of The Thinking Atheist, Seth Andrews, will MC. The speaker list includes Dr. Steven Pinker, Ed Buckner, Aaron Ra, and the keynote speaker, Paula Abzel, senior executive producer of NOVA. They've got some early bird pricing going, so check out the link on our show notes for the complete list of speakers and events, and do it with great haste. Oh yeah, and follow us on FaceTube and subscribe to us on Twitch or Plus, and don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes or wherever the hell you found us in the first place. If you have questions, comments, or death threats, you'll find all the contact info on the contact page at scathingatheist.com. All the music used in this episode was written and performed by yours truly, and yes, I did have my permission. why is it that immediately when we go live for Room Noise, I have to cough, sneeze, burp, fart, and scratch an itch?